This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my incredible and amazing and oh so curious friends. Do you realize how great it is to be curious? Hi, my name is Jed Lee, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, artists, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Right now, please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hello, Jed. How are you doing today?
I am awesome. It is a beautiful day, and my mind is alive and awake, and I can't wait to solve some problems.
Oh, we have some amazing problems to solve today, and this person on our show today is going to help us solve some big ones.
Ooh. Can we get right to it?
We can, but you have to spin the wheel.
Here we go. All right, here we go.
Why do we need to know how things break?
Why do we need to know how things break? I mean, I know how to break things. I like breaking things. It can be a lot of fun. But I don't know why we need to know how they break.
I agree with you. Breaking things is fun. But there's a science and engineering to why we need to know how they break. And we are excited to welcome Dr. Marcia Tuft to the show. She's a mechanical, aeronautical, and material science engineer, and she's gonna help us understand all of this.
Hey, welcome to Solve It for Kids, Dr. Marcia.
Thanks for having me, Jen and Jed. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, we are excited. So I looked at your bio, and you have degrees in mechanical engineering, aeronautical engineering, and material science engineering. First of all, why did you get all three of these, and what did you do for your job? What do you do for your job?
Well, I started off getting my Bachelor of Science from Mechanical Engineering, Purdue University. Then I signed on with GE Aviation in Cincinnati, Ohio, and we make aircraft engines for all kinds of airplanes, from biz jets to the largest passenger planes out there. And part of my time at GE Aviation, I also worked on my master's in aerospace engineering immediately after joining. And then later in my early 30s, I went on to get a PhD in materials engineering because I was working in critical rotating parts where we care about how things break. So let me tell you a little bit about what engineers at aviation do. Okay. We had a really cool vision statement our president did, Joyce, came up with. It's, we invent the future of flight. We lift people up and we bring them home safely.
Oh, nice.
And that is just such a cool way to think about what engineers in the aviation business do. And my part was particularly focused on the bringing people home safely because, okay, engines have airfoils that do all the work, that generate the thrust, that allow the plane to move forward. But you have these big rotating discs, really massive, that store a lot of energy, and they rotate at really high speeds to be able to support the structure that allows the engine to do its job. And if you have a crack in one of those discs, and they fail, you can release chunks that could exit the nacelle of the engine or even go into the fuselage of the airplane, causing potential loss of the airplane and loss of life. So we really don't want anybody to crash in an airplane. So we have lots of design, analysis, and testing protocols that let us figure out safe operating limits. And we work closely with the FAA, who certifies our certification process. So there's lots of ways that we go about our jobs to make sure that we're designing and making safe engines.
Wow.
Okay, but part of that is you can't extrapolate beyond what you know. So you've got to figure out, how do things break? What are the failure modes? Can I test them? And can I know that I'm operating safely?
I never thought about that. There's a lot of different moving pieces inside an engine. Yeah. Can you, is there a ballpark number of things that are spinning around inside those engines at any one moment?
The simplest cord, the way to think about it, you have usually a fan. So you have a fan disc, you have blades. Okay. So that sucks the engine, that sucks the air into the compressor. The compressor could have anywhere from 1 to 12 or more stages, of disc or bliss or spools. And those can have, even 100 blades per stage.
Wow.
Okay. Then you get to, the combustor is not a rotating part, but that's where you burn fuel and you generate the hot gases that the turbine extracts energy from. So you have maybe 1 or 2 turbine discs, high pressure turbine discs. And again, blades, you could have 100 blades on each disc. And then often a low pressure turbine, which could be, 3 to 7 or 8 stages. And again, a lot of blades on that.
Wow.
Plus the rotating shafts that support everything and connect everything together. So there's a lot of pieces that move in a turbine, in an aircraft engine. And then you have stationary parts connected to the casings that also work with the blades to turn the airfoil and get the compression or the expansion that you need to extract the work.
So can you give us an idea how big is an airplane engine? And do airplanes have more than one engines, I hope?
Well, fighter planes don't. Okay, but they also have ejection seats.
That's true.
And some aircraft like the Navy Tomcat, those are 2-engine planes.
Yes.
But when you get to civilian aircraft, the very small passenger planes, Cessnas might only have one, but most commercial planes have at least 2 engines. Many have up to 4. Oh. But like the GE90, that engine is about a 10-foot diameter fan. In fact, it's so big that they have to figure out the routes over land that they can use to get from the different production facilities, because the overpass height may not be big enough for a truck with a plane to go on it. So they there's only so many planes. There's only some bigger cargo planes that have bay doors big enough to carry the engine. So you start getting into other constraints that you don't even think about. If you get bigger fan diameters, you can get bigger bypass ratios and more fuel efficiency. But then you start getting limits on how can you transport it and how can you get it to the service shop when you need to overhaul it.
There's so many moving pieces inside the engine, but there's also so many other things to consider. I never thought that, hey, you make an engine in one city and it has to go to another city to get put onto the plane, and then a third city when it needs to be repaired, because you can't just drive the airplane into the garage like you would a minivan.
Well, the smaller ones you can, but some of the big ones, that go on the largest aircraft can't.
Well, so these sound really expensive to make, and yet was it your job to figure out how to break them to see how they would react, or do you do it the other way?
Well, so I had many different roles within critical rotating parts life management. And when I did my PhD, there was a problem with a new high temperature material. So if you know anything about cycles, the hotter you can get the cycle, the more efficiency you can get out of it.
Okay.
But then when you get metals, metals start melting at a certain temperature.
Yes,
so you get high temperature alloys that are more creep resistant and can withstand higher temperatures. And now we even have ceramic matrix composites that can go even hotter. But every time you invent a new material, there are new failure modes. You can't necessarily expect it to behave the same way as the more established experienced materials. So then you have to test. So when I did a 3-year stint as manager of technical education programs, and I had to decide whether to continue in that or go back into engineering. And I rediscovered my joy of learning while working there. So I went back and negotiated a job back in my old department and worked on a PhD at the University of Dayton at the same time. And the problem I was trying to solve was why one material, Rene 88 DT, was exhibiting different behavior with respect to shot peening than I always like in Canal 718. And shot peening is a surface treatment process that gives us longer fatigue life because it gives us a beneficial compressive stress layer. So just think about pushing your two hands together.
Right.
Okay. There's a crack between my two hands, but it's not going to separate as long as I've got pressure. I'm locked together. That compressive stress field is keeping the crack from growing.
Right.
But if I lose that, or if my crack gets bigger, it's easier to separate my hands, and then that crack can grow, and then I can break my component.
So this is all dependent on the material. So certain materials will stay together and pushing, and certain materials will break apart more easily. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it's not just that, but it's the stress. So it's the load that you're applying. It's the temperature you're applying it at. And then it's the state of that beneficial compressive residual stress. So with powder alloys, we basically assume that there's a crack at the surface of every powder alloy. Okay, because powder has inclusions that can behave as cracks. Okay, and we analyze that as if there were a crack there. So we have to have either models and test data that show we have beneficial compressive residual stresses that are going to retard crack growth, or we have to know that we have enough safe operating life that the crack could grow to a critical size, but the aircraft would be retired or inspected before that crack could grow to a critical size. So there's layers and layers of safety that we have in our analytical methods.
So basically you have someone who inspects the planes all the time to make sure if there is a crack that it's not growing and it's just staying there the same.
So we have safe operating limits, yeah. And then before we reach those safe operating limits, the engine has to come off wing, has to be torn down and inspected. And then it gets refurbished and put back together. So, and every different component has different ways of inspection. So the blades, those can be inspected through a borescope inspection. So think of, you know, there's a port in the side of the nacelle. Think of an eye hole piece. And you can snake this tube through that has a camera at the end. And you can actually look at the leading edges of the blades as you rotate the engine. So you can actually inspect for cracks on the airfoils. So those are the pieces that really also affect the engine performance. And we can use diagnostics as we see, oh, if we're tailing off in performance, maybe there's something going on with the leading edges of our airfoils that we need to look at. So there's performance-based inspections, and there's durability-based inspections, and then fracture-critical-based inspections. And most of our components are ranked in terms of durability critical or fracture critical. And there's different procedures in place to make sure that we're operating in the safest and most efficient conditions possible.
You know, as I'm listening to you, there's a lot of things that I don't get, and that's okay because I don't get a lot of things. But the one thing that I do get is that engineering and your job, it's like going on an adventure. You're an explorer. You're not exploring space, but you're exploring all these different materials and how they work together and how they don't work together and how they break. And that's really exciting.
Engineers are fundamentally problem solvers. And the most fun I ever had was working at GE Aviation and solving the problem of, okay, why is this material behaving differently? How can I test it? How can I understand it? And actually, everybody is a problem solver. So you're all junior engineers. You just don't know it yet. You may not have the technical expertise to solve some of the problems I've solved, but the problem solving process is easily transferable across disciplines. So any problems that you learned to solve as a kid, your hobbies, you're learning things like project management and efficient workspace layout and things that can help you later in any career you go to.
So what you do is, so going back to why do you need to know how things break? So if you understand how it breaks, then you kind of work backwards to figure out how to prevent that issue from happening.
Exactly. So that could be, let's say for shot peening, we found that there were different process conditions for this mechanical process, this surface treatment, that if we could control the velocity of the particles hitting the surface of the disc, then we were always peening in a safe regime that always gave us good life results. But it meant that we needed more process controls on how we made our parts. And then there's the analytical piece. So if we know how things break and we're able to predict it, now analytically we have confidence that we are designing something safely. And it may be that we have to back off in the stresses and the temperatures, and we have to optimize the features on our discs so that we've got lower stress concentrations, so that we're not going to have something that's going to create a crack. So think of a stress concentration. If you take a piece of paper and you just pull on it, you just put it in tension, it's really strong. But now if you make a little tear in the center and you pull on it, you can rip that paper in half. That's exactly what we're trying to avoid with our engine parts. We're trying to avoid either creating that crack in the first place, that little rip, or having conditions sufficient that we can grow that crack and we can rip that paper in half.
Cool. This is just, it must be really exciting and really rewarding for you when you can make that discovery and know that this work that I'm doing here in the lab is going to help people stay safe as they fly home to visit their family and friends.
It's very rewarding. It's challenging. And we've had such a great team of people, too. That's the other thing. In the workforce, you're never solving problems alone. You're working in teams. So you don't have to know everything. You have to figure out what I know, what I don't know, and then what are the other pieces of the problem that I need help with? And then you can go get that help.
Right. But I also think I go back to your training. And this is the one thing that Jed and I have talked about with our young listeners before, because, you know, as a kid, you're like, what do you want to be? And you have to pick a major. And, and, you know, and for some kids, that's very difficult to do because you don't know what you want. But I love how it seems to me like your path changed. Like, you learned mechanical engineering. And then in your course of your job, it's like, oh, maybe I need to know a little more about aerospace engineering and how planes work. So then you went back and you learned about that. And then you started working with materials.
Yep.
So then you started, you know, you got more training in that. And I loved how that progression goes, so the kids can understand, like, if you're a mechanical engineer, you're not a mechanical engineer for life, right? You can change.
Well, so the great thing about engineering is, and the hard thing is, they're never going to be able to teach you everything you need to know in college. Yeah. They are teaching you how to solve problems. And maybe the problem you need to solve is this the right job for me? Is this the right discipline? Mechanical engineering is incredibly broad and very flexible. And you can parlay that into pre-med, law, all kinds of fields. And you can go, well, mechanical and aerospace are pretty much the same, except you get more specialized in aerospace. But the cool thing about engineering is once you learn how to solve a problem, you can figure out, okay, here's a different problem than I learned how to solve, but you've learned how to learn. And that's really what engineering problem solving is all about. Once you learn how to learn, you can accomplish anything. And if you're not afraid of failing, you can speed that learning curve up even faster, because often we need to know what a solution isn't as well as what it is to really give us the confidence that, okay, this solution is going to work. I need to stay away from this area over here. This result didn't quite work. But if you think of a line on a chart, a line is straight, but we don't necessarily know that our path is going to be straight. So the more data you get in between, you figure out what the problem really is. It's a better example might be the elephant, six blind men and the elephant. One feels the trunk and he feels it's thinks it's a snake. Feels the side and they thinks it's a wall. So that's the other part of problem solving in engineering. You keep asking questions to make sure that you understand enough about the problem and how your product is going to work, where you're going to use it. And as you push that envelope, you might discover other nooks and crannies. You might discover the feet. You might discover the tail. And it may not matter if there's a foot or a tail there if you're only operating on the small area right on the side of the elephant.
Well, one of the things we love to do here on the show is to help kids become problem solvers and help kids learn how to learn by giving them challenges. Do you have a challenge that you can give to our audience?
I have one of my favorite challenges is my great egg drop challenge. Now, some of you may have done an egg drop before. It's taking a fresh egg and putting it in some sort of device to allow it to fall onto a hard, flat surface from a height of maybe 7 to 8 feet, or you can go higher. But my challenge shows you a little bit about the math so that you learn about mass and velocity. And I would like to add a twist to this challenge to encourage you to come up with your own crash test dummy so that you can try and see if you can predict whether your fresh egg is going to crack or stay safe.
Oh.
So think about what does a good crash test dummy have to be. And by the way, I always recommend that you bag your fresh eggs so they break. Your mom or your dad doesn't have a nasty cleanup.
Or you.
And, I've still saved my remnants for omelets. So.
So don't drop it on the floor.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you wash your egg first, you put it in the plastic bag, you just fish the shell pieces out, and then you scramble it. It saves you half the scrambling step.
That's a great challenge. And, of course, we love crash test dummies. As I told you before, and as Jed knows, I have a book called Save the Crash Test Dummies, which is about the history of car safety engineering, but applies to planes as well. So, kids, if you want to do that fun challenge, we would love to see pictures or, draw them, take pictures and send us. You can tag us on our social media at KidsSolve. We would love to see that. I think this has been so cool learning about how things break and why that's so important. Don't you think, Jed?
Absolutely. Yeah. I loved it. And I learned so much. And I love remembering that solving the problem start with understanding what the questions are and what the problems are.
Exactly. So thanks so much for being on the show, Dr. Marcia.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Wow, Jennifer, that was amazing.
It was so much fun because now we can break things and then while we're doing it, learn how we break things. I love that, right?
Yeah, it's like if someone gets mad that we broke something, we can say, hey, I'm sorry I broke that, but there was a reason behind it. It was science.
Exactly. And I hope all of our listeners out there will try Dr. Marcia's egg drop challenge because I think that would be really cool. Take your pictures or draw a picture and send it to us on our social media, which is at KidsSolve on Twitter and Instagram. And don't forget to check out the website where we'll have tons of information about Dr. Marcia and more. Maybe if we can find videos about cool things that break.
Yeah. And that website is solveitforkids.com.
Yes, that's where you can find us.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer, this has been a blast. I can't wait for next week when we have another episode of
Solve It for Kids.